Hi, and welcome to thedigitaltrekker.com. I'm Matt Brandon, and this is Depth of Field. Depth of Field gives you, the listener, a chance to look behind the scenes at the lives of working photographers. Over this series, we hope to give you a glimpse as to what it takes to succeed in the world of photography. Today, we speak with British photographer Gavin Goff, a travel photographer that's based out of Bangkok, Thailand.
Welcome to Depth of Field.
It's nice to be here, Matt.
Well, we have tried this a couple of times a day, and it looks like maybe it'll work now. So let's just keep our fingers crossed. That's right. So,
yeah.
Hey, well, listen, I think the best place to start is probably at the beginning. Mm. So, Gavin, tell us a little bit your backstory. Where did you come from? Where did you start in getting into photography? Who are you?
Who am I? Let's start with the important questions, the existential questions.
Yes, that's right.
Well, some people call a travel photographer. Although, as I say that, I can hear David Duchman grinding his teeth in despair.
Exactly, right. But world photographer.
World photographer, humanitarian photographer, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I currently live in Bangkok. I moved here about a year ago from the UK. I'm originally from the UK, southern England. And I've been a professional photographer for since about 2003, Matt, so about 6 years now. And that really kicked off. I mean, previously I was, I hesitate to admit it, but previously I was working as a systems analyst for a large firm. So I was working in IT, and I asked if I could take a sabbatical. I'd been working there for quite a while, and I really wanted to get out and see some places. So I asked for 12 months off, which I thought was a bit cheeky. They agreed and said it was a bit cheeky and offered me 3 months off. And I thought, no, you know, 3 months is really not going to do what I want to do. So we took a year off, and we booked a round-the-world ticket, and we went off and travelled. And we were very fortunate. We went to lots of really exciting places, and it was such a treat. Sorry, go on.
Wait a minute. You asked for a year off. They said, no, we'll give you 3 months. So did you quit and take the year off? Is that what you did?
I did, yeah. I mean, they said we've calculated how valuable you are to us, and we're only going to give you 3 months off. And I mean, 3 months would have been great, but I just knew it wasn't going to be sufficient, really. So we took the year off, and we'd saved some money, and we kind of treated ourselves to have that year without the need to earn any money.
It was that you and your mum?
That was me. My mum wanted to come, actually. Yeah, bless her. But she just at the last moment, she decided she couldn't get everything she needed into a suitcase, so I had to take my girlfriend instead.
Bummer.
She was pleased about. So we went to South America. We had 3 months in South America, which was great. We went off to the South Pacific, and that's just not something that, you know, from the UK that you would get the opportunity to do unless you had the time, really. Mm-hmm. So we bummed around the South Pacific for a little while, and then we went to New Zealand and Australia and had some in Southeast Asia, and finished off with a month's trekking in Nepal, which is always a nice thing to do. Okay. So
took a year off. Now, how did photography play into this?
Well, I think, I mean, for a long time I'd had ambitions to work as a photographer, and I used to phone up stock agencies and pretend that I was a buyer looking to buy images in order to persuade them to send me their stock catalogues.
Hmm.
So that was a real kind of pipe dream, something that you know all about, pipe dreams.
Thanks a lot.
Well, being a pipe smoker as
well. Oh, that. Okay, got it. Okay.
Yeah, sorry.
I thought you just meant my failed career. Is that...
Bless you. No, keep up, Matt. So we took the year off, and I mean, a lot of that was really me hoping that I would get some decent images whilst I was away and come back with a portfolio of some description. I wasn't really sure what I was looking for. It was all a bit hit and miss. It was a Canon 5, so it was an old film, 35mm film SLR. And that was entertaining, trying to get Fuji Velvia slides processed in somewhere in the outback in Bolivia. That was quite a challenge.
Yeah.
But it was all good. It was all good. And I came back with some good images, quite a lot of quite bad images. But I think most importantly, I came back with the experience of photographing in different cultures and photographing in foreign lands, which was really what my aim had been.
Mm-hmm. And so what did you do with your images?
Well, so then I started, I wanted to say pimping them. That's probably not very polite, is it? But that's what I started doing. I started sending them off to libraries, and I tried to put a portfolio together. And really, I mean, the learning curve for me at that point was significant, because my background's not in photography. I'd not worked in as an assistant. I didn't really have any dealings with professional photographers, so it was all new to me. And so I spent a lot of time researching, finding out what kind of pictures were selling, buying magazines and, you know, inspecting them to see what kind of pictures were in there. And then just sending them out to agencies and writing polite letters, making phone calls and trying to get some interest. And I think what I found was that without not having a profile of any description at that point, being the new kid on the block, it was very difficult to get people to pay attention, really. And in all honesty, a lot of the pictures I'd taken were very similar to pictures that anybody could go and get at any time. So one of the first things I learned is that you really have to be providing something that's a little bit different or a little bit extra or just has a little bit of pizzazz to it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I don't know, it was such a... I was so enthusiastic to do it, and I really... in my naivety, I didn't want to contemplate the fact that I might not succeed in doing it. So I think that helped, really. That kind of blind passion for it really helped, because I just kept plugging away. And then eventually I started getting some interest from agencies. I had a couple of bigger agencies get in touch with me once I'd put together a reasonable website. And
they got in touch with you because they searched the net and saw your work, or you had chased them down?
Well, no, interestingly, when I was chasing them, I wasn't getting a response. But then I started contributing to some magazines, and I got a few articles in magazines, and some people picked up on those. My website helped a lot, and I started getting that promoted in magazines. And then I think editors started picking up on the RSS feed. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and really it came together very quickly. In the space of a week, really, I had three, you know, what I'd consider to be quite big agencies get in touch and offer me a contract or at least a discussion about what we might be able to do together.
Now, I know you have shot and submitted for Lonely Planet, right?
Yes.
And then did you do any of the other biggies like Corbis or Getty or somebody like that?
Getty, yeah, I shoot for Getty as well. And Lonely Planet was really the one I was aiming for. I always thought Lonely Planet books were the kind of epitome of the kind of photography I wanted to make. So I was chuffed. I mean, they require quite a large submission. They want 500 pictures to begin with.
Right. Well, that was actually my next question. Was did you have 500 pictures to be able to give them?
I had 500 pictures, Matt, but whether I had 500 decent pictures is a different question. I struggled. I mean, I went out and took, I put myself on the train to France and took a few more pictures over the weekend. I went to Amsterdam and took some pictures there. I went to London and took some pictures there. So I supplemented what I had.
Yeah. See, that's the great part about living in Europe, because you can, you know, go 2 hours and you're in a different culture.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so you are you still submitting to these guys? Are they still getting your images?
They are, yeah. I mean, Getty is kind of the giant, really. And you know, people, you either have a love or hate relationship with Getty, but I like them. I mean, they do a good job for me. At the end of the day, I've got to earn money, and they earn me more money than anybody else. So. And they've treated me very well. They're the only agency that's sat me down and had a meeting with me. And my editor there spent several hours with me. So and they're in regular touch. I have regular contact with them. They give me good feedback, so I have no complaints about Getty at all.
Well, that is nice that they actually give you feedback and stuff on your images.
Yeah, for sure. No, I mean, and that's crucial for me mm-hmm. because, you know, you want to know what they can sell, mm-hmm. and they know the market better than anybody. So it would be foolish not to take their advice, or at least, you know, not to seek their advice.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so now you got a little bit of money coming in from stock. Is mm-hmm. this your sole income these days, or what? How else are you putting food on the table? Because I know you're putting food on the table because you went out just a while ago and bought groceries. So
I did go out this morning and buy groceries. Yeah, that must have been a Getty check that arrived.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, well, we do, since I've been in Bangkok, we've set up a colleague of mine and myself, Jackie Rado. Mm-hmm. She's a portrait photographer in town, and she's a very dynamic little Scottish lady, and she'll hate the fact that I said she was little, but she is, and there's no escaping that fact. So we've set up the Bangkok Photo School, which really is a series of night classes and kind of one-off workshops and tutorials. So we started offering those, and I was amazed, actually, the amount of interest there is locally in photography. Hmm. There's a lot of people, you know, they've got SLRs. They're not entirely sure what to do with them always, but they're really keen to learn. So that's really taken off much, much more than I expected. So that's been quite pleasing.
What are you teaching him? I mean, because you do a lot of, if you were to call it a genre, probably, I guess you would say it's street photography. And so, is this what you're teaching him, or are you doing studio stuff, or what other stuff are you teaching him?
No, Jackie does more studio photography, but it's not really my forte. So, we have three classes. They progress from a beginner's course, kind of what we call Foundation 1 and Foundation 2, and then we have an experienced course. So we start off with the basics, and we say, this is a camera, this is an aperture, this is a shutter, this is how they work. Mm-hmm. So we start very simply, and then we move up to, we have field trips where we get them to do some street photography, and so we run through right up to, we reach the point where I've run out of knowledge, which doesn't... Might not take that long, actually.
Well, it's handy, though, because then you could say, you need to just go out and experience that and find that out yourself, right?
Exactly. You know, the great thing about teaching is that it really makes you learn. So if you're going to go and teach a class of 14 people about, I don't know, depth of field or whatever, then you know there's going to be a lot of questions. The first thing you do is go to the library and swat up on all that stuff. Mm. So the amount of stuff I've learnt because I've been teaching has been phenomenal, really.
Hmm. Have you been able to apply it to your photography, though? That's the big question.
I try. I do try, Matt. I try.
Okay, so then you're also doing workshops as well, right? I mean, people just call you up and say, hey, I saw your stuff on the net. I'm going to be in Thailand. I want to do a workshop.
Yeah, so we've got about 50% people that are just coming through, perhaps they're on their way somewhere else, and about 50% local people. And we take them out, or I take them out for half a day or a day. We go to the local markets, perhaps we go to Chinatown, some of those really photogenic locations. Mm-hmm. And we have a very casual, easy time, really. We walk around and we'll find the things we want to photograph, but we'll talk about composition. We'll talk about getting the exposure right. We'll talk about capturing decisive moments. And it's really nice working with people one-to-one like that because you can see very quickly how people's photography improves just from simple things, just from camera settings, just from being prepared. You know, one of the first things we teach is get your camera set up how you want it. Be ready to shoot at any given moment. So all those things help, and that's I enjoy that. I find that quite rewarding.
So you and I have talked on many occasions about sort of our philosophy of street photography and things, and you blogged about it recently as well, and I've noticed that every time I mention it, like just recently or yesterday, I blogged something, and people kept talking about the fear of going up and shooting images of people that just absolutely terrifies people. How do you get over that? I remember you and me and David out shooting, and David was saying, "Oh, you see that lady with the umbrella? I'd love to shoot her." And I had actually seen her 5 minutes before and was totally petrified to go up to her and just say, "Hey, can I do it?" And then when David mentioned it, you turned around, walked up to her, and just said, "Hey, can we take some pictures of you?" And she acquiesced, and I happened to walk by and see it and stole some pictures too. So, so what's the secret?
How does that work? Mm-hmm. Gosh, I wish that I really don't think there is a secret. I think it's. I think partly it's back to that kind of blind enthusiasm. I'm so keen to get a photograph of that person, not at all costs, but you know, I'm filled with enthusiasm for it. And I think, at least I hope, that comes across. I understand why people find it awkward, because it can be a quite intimidating thing to do, standing in front of somebody, putting a big camera up to your eye and taking photographs, and it can feel like you're taking something from them. So I think the important thing is not to take something, but to make it an exchange. Mm-hmm. And the exchange, the kind of personal engaging with that person, should come before there's any talk about cameras, photographs, or anything. I think you have to be interested in that person, and you have to think of it as that you're paying them a compliment, really. What you're saying essentially is that there's something about you that I find so interesting or appealing that I'd like to capture it, I'd like to take it home with me. And I think that's a complimentary thing, and certainly that's the reaction I tend to get anyway, is that I very rarely seem to upset people. Well, I upset people all the time, but not when I'm photographing.
Right, yeah.
So I think it's you just need to be friendly. Just need to be.
But Gavin, realistically, you can't walk up to everybody that you photograph and talk to them and then take the picture. I mean, you lose that moment.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, it works for nice, you know, pose sort of portrait type stuff.
Sure.
Or if you can get them back into doing their job, but there are occasions when you're just going to have to. Crouch across the street and shoot the image, right?
Well, sure, and then I think it comes down to confidence, that you have to be confident that if they turn around and make eye contact with you, that you're going to be able to present yourself in such a way that's not threatening, and that it's not, you don't need to be furtive or secretive about it. You can be just very open about it. So I think it's about intent, really. If your intent is to steal a photograph, then that's you're going to come undone by that. If your intent is to capture something precious about somebody, then I think that will come across. So,
do you have any
approach it with the right intentions?
Yeah. Do you have any kind of situations where you wouldn't take a photo in?
I don't. I've learned in Thailand, people don't like to be photographed when they're eating. And I think that's probably true generally. And I try not to take pictures of people when they're eating. There are often people sleeping around the markets, but I try not to take pictures of people when they're sleeping. I don't know. I just try to not take pictures of anybody.
Is it voyeuristic, you think?
Well, I think there are some nice photographic opportunities sometimes with people stretched out on cardboard boxes. But I just wonder how I would feel if I woke up and found some gurning lunatic standing over me with a camera, and I probably wouldn't be best pleased. So it's about intent again, really. And whilst that I've missed some interesting photos by not taking them in that situation, I'd prefer to do that, really. I don't know. I mean, generally, just anything where I feel if the roles were reversed, that I would be uncomfortable.
About walking into people's homes.
Yes, no, don't walk into people's homes. And you don't need to walk into people's homes. You know, you get invited into people's homes. I know you do for a fact, and I certainly do. I get invited into people's homes all the time. And we get invited to photograph friends and family, and, you know, it can become an event almost. You know, here's the photographer. Let's all get together. Let's get some pictures made. Digital is great. Being able to show people their pictures in the LCD screen is good. And you and David have those Pogo printers, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which so you print out on the spot.
Great. It is a great tool. And there have been times when I have, like just recently, I was over on the other side of Malaysia and shot some stuff in a village. And it, for some reason, it just wasn't working that day with my camera. I don't remember now what the problem was, but I think the batteries might have been low or something. But the next day, I got it working. I printed off like 5-6 images. And then I left it with somebody that I knew those people. And so, you know, even then, it was still something that it allowed me to know that I can go back in a year from now and not feel like they're going to look at me and say, oh, you're the guy that came promised a picture but didn't give it or something. Because I don't know how many photographers, and I mean, I used to do this. I know. It's not an easy thing. But we get out there in the mountains or in some city, and we take a picture, and they go, oh, can you send us the picture? And we have every intention of sending that photograph.
Yeah.
But we don't. We don't end up doing it.
No, it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, sometimes it's even difficult to get an address from people that you think would ever work. So,
that's
an issue too. But I think it's I think you can try. I mean, I've done this. I've been out trekking in Nepal or something, and there's no way to get prints to people. But when you get back, I've got back to Kathmandu, had some prints made, given them to the guide who I know is going back to that area perhaps next month. And, you know, in the hope that some of those prints will reach those people. And I think it's, you just have to remember, you're not going to be the last person walking through that place. You're not going to be the last photographer. And, you know, I know it will be, I'd be happy to walk through a village that you'd been photographing in the month before, because I'm going to get a good response from people. People will have good memories of the experience they had with you.
Yeah.
And that will help me. So equally, I've got to do the same for the next guy, because that might be David Duchemin, and you know what a fuss he kicks up when he doesn't get his pictures. So,
absolutely.
So you've got to think about that. You've got to think that this is not where the story ends. You know, someone else is going to follow in your footsteps.
Yeah, that's right. And I, you know, and there's always risks. There are things that don't work. I mean, that's life in the field. You have to be ready to change something. Something's not going to work. Somebody's not going to... We gave some pictures to a village guide at one time. I had about 150 prints made for this whole, essentially the whole village. And I told them all, I had prearranged that it was going to be at this little grocery-like store there in this little village up in Kashmir. And so we went back, we found the store, gave him 150 prints, and then 3 months later, we come back through thinking everybody's going to be happy with us, and everybody is really ticked, you know? And I'm like, what's the problem? Why is everybody giving me these nasty looks? We found out that the guy was selling the prints to everybody. So it doesn't always work.
Well, I don't know what to say, apart from you did it with the best of intentions, and there's part of me that quite admires his entrepreneurial skills.
Exactly.
He must have thought that was his lucky day. It's going, wow, this guy's given me 150 prints. That's how many rupees each? I'm going to be, that's fine. That's going to keep me going
close
for a while.
Shop early today.
He probably thought he was your agent in that part of the world. That's what it was.
We're going to pause here in the interview and pick it up again for part two. So I hope you've enjoyed what you've heard so far. It was a delightful conversation that Gavin and I had, and you can hear the rest on part two coming your way on thedigitaltrekker.com. I'm Matt Gray.